Welcome to another episode of Yelling at
Ba 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 ba.
Sorry, folks, couldn't stop them.
Ba 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 ba.
You know, I paid for that music. I paid for that music, Mike. But anyway, welcome again to another episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. And actually, we're looking at Miri this week. Yes, I know I promised Dagger of the Mind, but I was looking at production order. Dagger of the Mind is first. But this week, we're looking at Miri. A very bizarre episode with an alternate Earth. Mike, did you happen to look at the Google blurb on what this episode's about?
Yes, the blurb for what this weird, wacky episode is about. My goodness. Okay. This is Michael Pontone, co-host of my captain, Matt Ross, yelling at gaseous anomalies, etc., etc. Yes. Okay, Kirk and landing party discover a replica Earth trapped in the year 1960 and inhabited only by children. After learning that a plague has wiped out all the adults, the crew fear they will become the next victim of the disease. Let's throw out some our own titles, our own pitches for this episode. Children of the Corn meets Kirk flirting with a woman who certainly looks underage, but you see, you have to let him explain that she's actually over a century old, so it's all fine.
Well, she's 300 plus, so she's like 313, so, you know, that's okay, you know. But this is actually a combination of Lord of the Rings and I Am Legend, if you really think about it.
Where did you get Lord of the Rings from?
Not Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Flies.
Excuse me, I mean Lord of the Flies. Yes. Close enough. It's a very weird thing. It actually starts weird. It's one of the few episodes where we're arriving on a planet with no name. The script called it Earth 2. It's written by Adrian Spies, a person who was not a science fiction writer. He was good for drama, apparently. He can write, although there were numerous revisions, just like always. It was Roddenberry and Justman and John Black writing changes to this up to the last moment. This is a weird, weird one. I mean, you come to an Earth that's literally exactly the same Earth with no name, and you have to go to the Star Trek Memory Alpha and Beta to find out that it could be called Juran 5, or it could also be called Earth 2 anyway, and that it is was a duplicate copy by an alien race known as the Preservers that you don't know about truly until a later episode in TOS. Or you could find out more about them in a TNG episode. But this was just, I don't know, once I saw the Earth, when I originally saw this, I was like, what the hell? What is this, like another dimension or something? I don't know. It never really sat with me that it was a second Earth. What were your impressions?
Yeah, wait, hold on. This, I thought I missed something. There's never an explanation as to why it looks exactly
nope,
like Earth.
It just is. In fact, that's one of the funniest lines I find in the opening of the Captain's Log. It seems impossible, and yet, there it is.
Captain's Log, Stardate 2713.5. In the distant reaches of our galaxy, we have made an astonishing discovery. Earth-type radio signals coming from a planet which apparently is an exact duplicate of the Earth. It seems impossible, but there it is.
It's one of the, yeah.
Dude, that sucks.
Yeah.
I thought, you said, we talked about this during the episode. I was like, what, why is it Earth? Why is it another Earth as opposed to just some alien planet? And you're like, oh, just keep watching.
But it would,
and there's
no,
nothing?
It was nothing, because it is. It's the way it is. It was not terrible.
Matt,
it was terrible.
Listen, let me tell you, man. I'm what, 8 episodes in here? 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1? It's TOS so far is very underwritten.
Well,
in most of the episodes.
We get to keep in mind most of the things right now are considered to be essentially one-act plays. This is the beginnings of television. That's what these all are.
But how do you show the central conceit is that you're coming to a place that is another Earth? We see the Horn of Africa. We see the United States. we say it looks like the 1960s, and then they never acknowledge that?
Yeah, it's, again, one of those weird situations. It doesn't have to make sense. You have to go forget looking at the planet Earth and the sets and with Lieutenant Dork on the bridge. You have to kind of just go with it. There's plenty of bad science fiction at times, but no one was...
I'm going to make this my indictment of this series so far. I'm just going to say this, right? We are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,
still
eight episodes in. Okay. Mantrap, Salt Vampires, pretty good, holds together. Charlie X, pretty good, holds together. Naked Time and The Enemy Within, yes. Everything else, I don't know what's happening. I don't know who's doing what for what reason. It's like they were just high as kites. They had to move on to the next thing. And it's like, hey, intern, grab this. You know it's not done. Shut the fuck up. Well, put it
wasn't
on.
It wasn't interns. It was actually professional writers. But, you know, science fiction on television was a new concept. So, new concept like...
Bullshit, though.
No, with these hour-long contiguous stories. This concept of having a... continuous, in the sense of continuity. It's the same characters, they're on some sort of thing. That's a new idea. The Twilight Zone, again, is one... one-act plays in a half hour. Same things with The Outer Limits. You had UFO Monsters of the Week episode. This is... If you really take your annoyance at the fact that it's another Earth, this is an interesting concept of a plague has come down onto this planet. But that's something we're going a little ahead. Once you get over the...
Five seconds. You want to see 5 seconds of making this better? The eugenics wars from the late 90s. A portion of them, of the scientists involved with that, go off on their own spaceship to a different planet. They arrive there. It takes 100 years. They're trying to do the eugenics test to extend life indefinitely. This is what happens. They build a society that looks vaguely like Earth because that's what they know.
That's a great idea, except the idea of eugenics, a federation, a Starfleet, still has not existed. This is actually a turning point on many levels. I will tell you.
I'm going to stop bitching about the episode.
I will tell you. The turning point is the hiring of Gene L. Kuhn, who became a producer. He began creating concepts to have more continuity and things to make more sense and tightening up the scripts and basically to rein in Roddenberry a little bit between him and Justman. Everyone says that Roddenberry is the genius behind everything. He came up with the initial idea. This is actually what he wanted was some general ideas, but it's the people behind the scenes that actually made it work together. Gene L. Kuhn is one of them. He began on this episode. He came in at the last second with like a couple of days left before shooting, and he made the characters seem less stilted, which is kind of hard to imagine. Like, for example, when we get down, we meet our first character, Miri, which I always think is, I know it could be short for Miriam, but it's actually mirror, at least in my head. They get down there, and she exposits everything. Gene L. Kuhn made little tiny subtle changes, like they figured out that why their Miri is calling them grubs. But let's just first get to that point in a second. We beam down. We don't check to see if anything's weird. There's a distress signal. And they go down there without any protective gear to this planet that looks, well, if you know Mayberry, well, there you go. That is actually the town of Mayberry. It's on the Desilu lot from the Andy Griffith Show. You can even see that's the names of the same stores over there, but it looks like it's been through hell. What's funny about it is that the sets were decaying, so they actually saved some money to make it look like it was decaying, and it is the 60s, those items over there. But they get down there. They find nothing. They have their two red shirts with them that in this instance do not die but are otherwise useless. And what did you think of the set when they were walking around? Did you have any impressions of that? Did you know it was the Andy Griffith Show's Mayberry at all, or no?
I figured it was some ranch out in California. I mean, why else? I figured that whenever in the original series they were shooting something, you know, in an Earth-like setting, whether they were going back in time to an old Earth, or don't they like go to some planet where there's Lincoln at some point?
That's all on a set.
Like, I always figured that
that's on a set.
Yeah, of course. I'm always figuring that it's like, okay, what do we got? We got access to this set. All right, well, we're supposed to be in space. We're supposed to be millions of light years away from Earth. How do we write the plot of the show to use these Earth sets? And apparently they could just not get past, it's a second Earth. I don't know why either,
but I will tell you, this is Desilu 40 Acres in Culver City. You had Mayberry, which was right next to the train station from Gone with the Wind. There was an Arabian village, which was actually used in The Cage and later in Errand of Mercy. You also had Camp Henderson from Gomer Pyle, and around the corner from that, you had Stalag 13 from Hogan's Hero. So this is actually a very busy place. But in this situation...
You know, Stalag 17 was one of my favorite films of all time, and that inspired Hogan's Hero.
Yes, well, Stalag 13 is... Well, we could get into that another, all of it, the weird peccadillos of its star. But in this situation, they...
You're a peccadillo.
Yeah, thanks. The town looked, I thought, pretty nice weathered look to it, of a town that's in trouble. And then we come across a tricycle... And it's odd that Spock's not scanning for any, like, biologics or anything like that. Everyone's dead. And, you know, Grace Lee Whitney says that genius line of, you mean everyone's dead? No, they're all around and they're walking around. It's invisible, Captain Obvious. That's what I kept thinking. She wasn't, she was pretty much an appendage in this episode. But we come to the first instance where you actually were surprised with the tricycle and the weird zombie-like creature attacking McCoy.
I mean, I was impressed that it was pretty terrifying and graphic and like in full Technicolor. I'm like, Jesus, that's terrifying. I mean, that was like on par with what the horror movies were doing at that time. Maybe
brought
worse.
To you by NBC and Living Technicolor. Yeah, it was pretty disturbing to see that guy with his face all like mottled and falling apart, yet acting like a child going, mine, mine. He's asking them to fix it, and he dies. And, you know, the only thing he didn't say was Rosebud. I know it's not a sled, but...
Rosebud!
It's close. But what I thought was interesting is when he comes right at them, Kirk and Spock holds him. Kirk beats the crap out of him. Where was security during this time? Where were they like, you know, oh, we were around the corner? I don't know. They didn't, they just like around the block and do anything. But to me, the funny line of that scene is when he's saying, we'll help fix it. We're here to help you. The guy laughs maniacally going, never, never. And to me, it sounds like a mantra of the 60s is never trust anyone over 30. That's what that actually sounded like to me.
Yeah.
When he was saying that.
I mean, again, I don't know, you know what the inspirations of this episode was. I think that it was someone with half an idea. And I also think that it was some weird, creepy thing where it was the 60s and they were like, hey, man, come on. Age of consent. That's just... That's just like a suggestion, right? I mean, this is right around the same time where we were having awful things like the Roman Polanski stuff and, you know, all sorts of awful, awful stuff. The awful hangover of the sexual revolution where it was just like, actually, some of these things are, you know, the box is there for a reason in a couple of places, man.
Well, the idea originally behind it was when Adrian Spies went to go over and pitch this to Gene Roddenberry, he said that I wanted to come to a planet where the children were really, really old. Gene liked the idea and said, you got to come up with their own language, too. So that's where grups and onlys come from. Originally, like I said, when we meet our main character or titular character, Miri, she was originally explaining everything that grups were grown-ups, but Janice Rand is the one who comes up with the idea that grups are grown-ups and onlys are the only ones left in that run-down house. And that's where we find out that there's some sort of weird disease that's wiping out or wiped out all the adults who went mad and destroyed everything, and that the only ones left, or all that is left, are the onlys, or the children, which then Spock and security go out to look for. And that was kind of bizarre. What did you think of that idea of a plot line of all the adults being wiped out? I know you probably wanted the writers' room wiped out, but what did you think?
I mean, great concept to start, and, you know, has to go someplace, but, you know, it's, again, it's a good recurring concept that you've seen in a lot of good fiction. Like, did you ever read the original Children of the Corn short story?
Actually, I did not read that one. I think I left off at thinner, mainly because I got stuck on the Burger King scene with eating too many double Whoppers. Of course, I also worked at Burger King, so maybe that resonated with me extra special.
Yeah, I read thinner when I was 10. It was my first. I didn't even realize it was a Stephen King book because he did it under a pseudonym, Richard Bachman. But Children of the Corn is that this couple comes to this town where there are only children and all the adults have been slaughtered, and basically the head child is like communing with some sort of evil force, which they just refer to as He Who Walks Behind the Rows of the Corn. And he who walks behind the rows advises them to kill anyone over the age of 18. It's like, is it mass hysteria or is there actually some kind of like Lovecraftian monster always kind of just out of sight?
That's more like also Village of the Damned too, from 1960. It's kind of similar to that, except these children are not psychically enabled. But the world that we're in right now is totally destroyed. I think the next part we walk on over with Miri is to the bad place where the doctors have their pills and stuff. And they find a whole bunch of dusty files. Luckily for our heroes, they didn't have come to the digital age because they'd really be screwed. Yeah. And they find that it's a life prolongation experiment, where they were trying to create something to make humanity on this world last a lot longer than the average human being does anywhere. A eugenics experiment.
Right. And it's like, hey, listen, sounds cool when they're talking about how, okay, viruses. Well, what do we know about a virus that we're not even sure if they're alive from the simple fact that they are, they never die, right? Viruses can live on indefinitely. You could freeze a virus 1,000 years and thaw it out and it could still infect someone. So,
well, these are retroviruses designed to manipulate genetic code, and they obviously did not calculate correctly, as Spock points out. But just in real life, we also use retroviruses too. And people always talk about like, well, we could take bacteria, or a veritable zoo of bacteria, and use it to create something to correct genetic defects in the species. Again, a eugenics ideology, which could probably lead to other problems. I mean, there's all sorts of theory where the pandemic we just lived through came through, whether it was actually made or was it came from natural causes or wherever the hell it came from. But who knows? I mean, if you take a look at the cures that were handed out, those were made quickly with different types of genetic manipulation to find a cure. So we're not too far away from doing this to ourselves anyway.
Quite true.
In a way that this episode is prescient in some regards. But luckily we haven't hit an Andromeda strain event and no one's released the Black Plague. It's still in storage and many weapons facilities around the planet around out
so
there.
So far, so good.
But this is... Yeah, so far so good. Fingers crossed. And you know what I also find interesting is that Spock does not get the disease. That was actually a specific note that came from the network because they wanted to prove how alien he is by showing how different he is. But yeah, it's kind of weird. I just want to also point out to you, we have a different communications officer. It's Lieutenant Farrell, that guy with a freaky face we called Lieutenant Dork in the last episode or two episodes ago. Yes.
Yeah, where's Uhura? Where's Scotty? Where's Sulu?
Hey, we got to save a budget, man. This cost almost $1.3 million in 2013 dollars. So that's like about like almost $2 million today. That's $200,000 back then. So he was actually a friend of one of the producers, John Black, who was leaving. So this, unfortunately, we say goodbye to our good friend, Lieutenant Farrell. I know you're upset, Mike. Calm yourself. But are you going to miss his ugly face?
Guy, God bless him. Come on. What does he care about me? Michael Pontone in 2024, but my God, he's got a face for radio, buddy.
Come on, Jim Goodwin, he's a swell guy. But yeah,
did you say that he had like a friendship with someone?
Yeah, yes, I said he's friends with one of the producers on the show. Because remember, it's not what you know, it's who you know, right? So there you go. Mm-hmm. You know, he was friends with one of the producers, John Black, who was number two on the set, but who was leaving. So this is why he's the last time. I'm sure someone said, get rid of that Durky-looking guy there. But here we are. Something interesting. You were pointing out the ages of everyone. Our main character, Miri, in real life, at that time, she was 18, playing a 13/14-year-old. But then we have someone else that you notice right away. Michael Pollard was hired for his quirkiness. He was 27, playing a 13/14-year-old.
Not for a second that I think that guy was a kid. Come on.
Yeah.
I know Michael Pollard.
But he's really creepy in that. You know, he was nominated for an Oscar later in Bonnie and Clyde. He was in a lot of things. Kim Darby was in True Grit, so she was all over the place. One of the comments that the director made about her was that it was difficult to deal with her more than the quirkiness of Pollard because she was a crybaby at one point, but she was either so into her script or whatever it was that the director was like, ugh, I don't have time for your drama. That's McEvity. He was saying that it was difficult. One of the things about this production is because there are children in it, everyone was sighing. You were going like, oh God, children. You know, that's one of the things that I understand is an issue in acting is like never work with children or animals. There are a lot of children in this who are playing animals, but what's one of the comments of the director was that they went one day over thanks to the kids. He was not really happy. In fact, that was the word in the memo goes, one day over schedule, children, underlined. I find that kind of funny. But what'd you think?
A lot of kids. That sure was a lot of kid extras.
Hello there, children.
Hey, Jim.
And they had to do it in the summer. This was an August episode. They had to do it in the summer because they're off from school. Some of those extra, though, the two of the people are Roddenberry's kids, or as my TOS book says, two people who got to call Gene Roddenberry daddy, in quotes, which is a little bit odd. It was the two Shatner kids, Leslie and Elizabeth. And then you also have one other notable person in there. You had Phil Morris, who's Greg Morris's son. Greg Morris is a star of Mission Impossible. Do you ever watch the original Mission Impossible?
I did not actually, but it's got what's his name, the guy who played Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood. Come on, Martin Landau, right?
Martin Landau is in a couple of those things, but Mission Impossible is another Desilu production. It's also a spy thriller show. It's kind of like it's what the movies are sort of based on, but I think the original TV show had some more unique stories, because apparently there are about, I bet you didn't know, there's about 8,000 unstable South American dictatorships in that show, or like an extra 500.
Is that the thrust of that show? Bunch of
kind of
Republics.
It's communism versus the true righteousness of the United States, you know, and also besides the 8,000 South American countries in South, in the South, there's also an extra 500 countries in the Warsaw Pact. So you have to go over and fight them all the way. But Greg Morris was one of the main stars. He was the tech guy. And his son Phil Morris is in this too. And he later comes out, you would actually know Phil Morris. He later becomes Jackie Childs from Seinfeld. The intern,
really?
The sleazy, yeah, it's actually kind of funny.
Of course, so. I know. He's a very good actor, actually. He's got quite the well-done career.
Jackie Childs. I love that guy. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, he was also on Smallville as a recurring character. He played John Jones, the Martian Manhunter.
Yep. But this over here was weird. We do find out that the retrovirus is killing them. They're coming up with a plan to solve it. They use a mini comp, a kind of useless computer, which those of you who are old enough kind of look like an Altair computer, which is without a screen, or kind of like a slot machine where Spock's punching in numbers, and an electronic microscope or an electron microscope. But, you know, I don't really fault the 60s idea of what tech in the future looks like. You have to use a little bit of your imagination and be kind of forgiving for what they had at the time. I mean, they did have communicators, which are our cell phones of today. But
hey, you know, I'm looking up this Altair computer. So if it didn't have a display screen, how would you get any results from it?
You'd have it plugged into what's known as a monitor, which is actually a typewriter.
Oh.
That's
okay.
What it is.
All right.
So the typewriter would type out the codes. You got to watch more 60s sci-fi. You can watch the Forbin, Colossus, the Forbin Project. You hear a lot of typing sounds in that.
No, you know what? The only reference I have to this is, do you ever see Willy Wonka when when they're saying, like, I'm going to now use this computer to tell me what the, you know, where to get the lifetime supply of chocolate. And
yeah.
It spits out like a little code thing.
Yes, and it was wrong. And everyone beat that guy to death.
What are you talking about?
Well, that was a scientist. That's in the book. Or are you talking about in the movie?
Oh, no, the movie. Yeah. I never read the book.
You know what a book is. It's like the internet written on trees. You know, it's pretty cool.
Yes, I like books. In fact, I read a Shirley Jackson short story in the bathtub yesterday. It was the first time I actually picked up a paper book and read a full short story in, Jesus, I don't know, months. I hate these screens, man.
I was just reading a Star Trek story, actually, because I got it as a recommendation. It's basically the Mirror Universe stories about, like, what happens, which you'll find out later in Star Trek, what happens to Mr. Spock and his adventures in the Mirror Universe. It's actually not a bad book. It's actually written by David Mack. I'm on the second one called Rise Like Lions. And that actually answers things that you would have remembered from Deep Space Nine's Mirror Universe story.
Of course.
So, but the first portion of it, whose name kind of escapes me, but I can probably find it for you, it was actually pretty interesting because it's all based off of the first Mirror Universe story. Right now I am in the midst of the area right after the Terran Rebellion in Deep Space Nine. So
who
it's kind
of
interesting.
The Terrans rebel against the Klingons?
No, the Terrans rebel against the Alliance, which is the Klingons and the Cardassian and Bajoran forces that are terrorizing the universe. Because at the fall of the Terran Empire, there's a power vacuum. But it's an interesting set of series. I'll tell everyone to take a look at the books by David Mack on the Mirror Universe. You can easily find it on Amazon or probably at a library. But we do find out, getting back to our story, which is, I know, just so riveting for you, Mike, we get to the point where the kids realize, like, hey, these grups are bad. You remember how it was in the old time? We got that weird-looking kid going, bonk, bonk, you know? Let's go get them. And they realize if they take the communicators, they can't solve anything. It's kind of weird. I just thought what was weird about it is the two security officers that went down with them are out in the field, but the rest of the crew left their communicators on their desk. I mean, it sounded like they were walking around with ancient Nokia phones that weighed like a ton.
Everyone left them on the desk. They didn't put it in the little holder.
Right. They didn't have them Velcroed to their belts. They just kind of left them on the desks. But what about the two security guards? They didn't have any their communicators. They couldn't get, like, hey, come over here, man, and let me contact the ship. because we find out they only have 7 days or 170 hours left of life before this bluish blobbish disease gets all over them. Did you have any opinion on, by the way, on the special effects for the blotches? I thought they were kind of neat, actually.
I thought they were excellent. I thought the coloring looked very good. It reminded me of a very strange horror movie from the 80s called Street Trash. This kind of vibrant blue-purple thing. In that movie, a bunch of people drink booze, contaminated booze, and then melt. It's a part of, one of the biggest, more well-known contenders in the very, very sub-genre of horror called melting movies.
Wasn't that the thing with the home? They first gave it to homeless people, and they put it in like cheap liquor or something. Wasn't that
yes,
movie?
Yes, exactly. It's just it's not like it was any. That's the thing too. It's never really explained. It's just that this liquor store finds this crate of old booze, and he marks it at like $1 a bottle, and the homeless people buy it, and when they take a sip of it, they turn into jelly in a very gruesome way. Yeah, you never actually figure out where that booze comes from. It just might have been old and bad. But the thrust of the story is not anything to do with that. But anyway,
the color looked good. 40 twice.
You know, I'm surprised you know that. You're not really a horror guy, right?
No, I'm not really a horror guy, but I do know some horror films. I mean, this is in a way a weird body horror kind of thing. You got blue blotches all over you.
It's, again, another episode that is criminally underwritten, good concept, no explanation, and it gets solved just kind of when we're like, well, we got 5 more minutes left. McCoy makes a vaccine that saves everyone.
And he injects himself without waiting to see if they could get an answer, but I can understand it. How are you going to find it? How are you going to find the answer without communicators to the ship? Trial and error. I do like the fact...
Go on.
No, I do like the fact that the effect that the blue stuff was like melting off of his face or is disappearing. That's actually pretty good special effects for 1966, in my opinion. I think that's pretty good.
Definitely not bad at the time. And just like, again, you're on an entire planet. Like, are we just on the one? Is this happening on the entire planet or just this tiny little section?
That's the whole planet.
This is happening in Montana. What's going on in Africa in this gigantic second Earth?
Everyone is dead except for this group of like 20 kids who are screaming around. They even get attacked by another one. We find the answer is puberty is what actually brings this change on, because your entire metabolic structure changes. Having a teenager, I can see what they're talking about. of course, living through it myself, and I'm sure you recall too, what a great time. So that was, I thought it was bizarre. Like when you turn a certain age, the disease that's used to prolong your life suddenly turns on you and kills you. It accelerates everything and turns you into that zombie.
I will say, Echoes of Future Past, the age-based thing affecting certain people and not others reminded me of, my sweetheart Star Trek Picard Season 3. With the Borg implantation that only affects people 25 years or younger.
It was ridiculous.
Which I thought was a very good price. No, I thought that was a great idea. It was a fantastic idea. It was a good concept as to, you know what? This is good writing. It's not just saying, oh, it affects some people but not others. I don't know. It's like, no. You're interlacing it with genetic material from someone's brain, and it only affects brains that are not done cooking. And it's well known the human brain is not done cooking until 25.
That's
kind of why I don't really believe
others.
In life sentences. What'd you say?
I could see some people where the cooking never stops. I'm not saying you,
course.
Sweetie.
No, of course.
But I got to tell you, though, that this is actually another episode of Mad Scientists when you think about it. Unfortunately, here all the mad scientists are dead. But you got like Corby. His mad scientist plot. You got back with our salt sucker mad scientist. I mean, it's a string of tropes, I would say. Crazy
this
situations.
Yes, but this is the third show in a row. I believe the third in a row, yeah. that everyone just stopped writing. They were just like, the show, the script's done. I don't care. I don't care if there's no explanation. It was Muslim.
They just ran out of they were running. Remember, this was actually rushed because the episode I thought we were on, Dagger of the Mind, ran over as well. Dagger of the Mind is superior to this. And I will tell you, and you're going to have to trust me, and those of you who are longtime fans know, the episodes get way better after this, and then some of the strongest Star Trek ever comes. Yeah, really.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yep, you got things coming up like the Corbomite maneuver. You've got Balance of Terror. You have Court Martial. You have a whole bunch of things that are coming up. Those are the titles of upcoming episodes. Dagger of the Mind is kind of Dagger of the Mind is beginning to see, you'll see Gene Kuhn is coming into this more, where there's more of a unifying force in this. But just kind of wrapping up this episode, what I think was bizarre was I think that there was like this jealousy of Yeoman Rand, and her lust for Kirk comes out, and a kind of an interplay of jealousies between Yeoman Rand and Miri over getting Jim Kirk's affections. What did you think of that?
Yeah, there was, yes, I thought it was creepy on all fronts. I thought that William Shatner was doing a way too much flirty direct eye contact with Miri. I will say though that watching this show, it does really strike home William Shatner is a pro. Because this script sucked, and he was not phoning it in at all. He was going for it. He was not. He was like, "I'm here to act. This is what my director and my screenwriter are telling me to do, and I'm not going to half-ass it." So I will say that, despite the terrible plot, once again, all-around best performances. I feel like so far, this series, 8 episodes in, is being carried by its cast.
Well, that's true. I mean, all these new shows start off a little rough, but it is the thing that made these shows exciting or different is because A, it was space, but also the general concept ideas people liked, the concept behind it, or a lot of people liked. I mean, although it did come behind other TV shows in the ratings consistently. These beginning episodes gave people an idea of a larger picture going on with the ships and the crews, etc. So I think that's its positive. And the actors in it, Shatner, Nimoy, Kelly, everyone, even Grace Lee Whitney, they do carry the weight of this episode by showing a professionalism, even though she acted like a jealous lover at that point. I think that does carry the weight in the show. By the way, one thing about that, I noticed, I don't know if you noticed, when she's crying because she's losing it, Kirk only gives her like a very friendly hug, not like he's interested hug, which I thought was actually very well carried out by Shatner. Did you notice that?
Yes.
Yeah,
pick up on that. I thought it was very well done.
And other than that, the no blah, blah, blah. I don't know. That entire scene just drives me crazy. He should have been dead by all those kids beating the crap out of him with whatever objects they had, especially with the guy with the weird teeth. His name was, I think, Chris Megna.
Yeah, I mean, that was very creepy. What was up with that?
Yeah, that was, he just, but that's actually... I don't know, but between the kids going, yeah, 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 and no blah, 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 I don't know, that really, it drives me nuts. But that's really bad. What were your, I think we're, I don't know what else we can hit upon this one, because...
Nothing happened, then it's just, show's over. Rating, okay, let's just see. Okay, let me just go. Weird thing, it was all weird.
The Second Earth, man.
Second, oh God, I hate this shit. Echoes of Future Trek. We got obviously Disease of the Week, and we also got the age thing only affecting certain people. Again, it reminds me of Star Trek Picard Season 3, which of course I don't think that in any way Terry Metalis would have aped it, but I'm curious if in the back of his head, as a huge Star Trek geek, and he's like, Well, it's kind of happened in that episode too, anyway. Yeah. Other than that, Kirk does a professional job. I would rate this the lowest of the low so far. I'm going to give this 2 out of 10.
Wow. I'm going to give it slightly higher. I'm going to give it a 3.5 to 4 out of 10. But that, to me, the weirdest, the WTF moment, as you elegantly have said in the past, is I think the second planet Earth, but that no blah, 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 that just drives me up the wall. I'm sure I might actually insert it here just because, you know, it beats yelling, I'm Captain Kirk every episode. But it is just, I don't know. All I can tell you is you're going to have to take my word for it. It does get bigger and better as we go along. This that's really basically all I have to say on this one. I don't know. We could talk about more books, but I don't think our audience is here for that. By the way, the first episode, book of that Mirror Universe thing is called The Sorrows of Empire, also by David Mack. Mike, you might want to read that after you see the Mirror Universe episode, which is known as Mirror Mirror, not Miri Miri, which we never see here again.
I feel like I have seen that.
How could you not see Spock? Right. Spock with the goatee. How could you miss that?
Spock with the goatee, the agonizers, right?
Right. The agony
horror looking fantastic, showing her tummy off.
Oh yeah, it's a totally sex-filled, sexy-looking filled episode where everyone's evil. What's interesting is the Mirror Universe episode actually relates to the next episode that I thought we were covering, which is Dagger of the Mind. It actually deals with it quite well. I'm not going to tell you what that is yet. But the hint is in the name of the planet's colony for Mirror Universe. It's an interesting episode that's coming up next. So I think that's pretty much about it. Mike, you said you gave it a 2, and I gave it a 3.5 to 4. You know what? Actually, I'm going to lower it. I'm going to give it a 3. This was just not good. But I think, all we have for this week at Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. And I assume we're going to see you real soon. The next one, which will be Dagger of the Mind. Mike, you have anything else you want to add?
No, I will just say that even though the journey is pretty rough, I appreciate the companionship, Matt. You're a fantastic captain in this endeavor. Thank Aww. You for guiding me. And yeah, even though there are some rough spots, you know, I'm still in it for the long haul. Because here's the thing, I do love the original cast, man. Like these are the ones I grew up with. I grew up watching. When I was a kid, I grew up watching the original series movies, the original cast movies, and TNG. And it was some really A-plus stuff. So
sure
I'm firmly believing that we will get there. Also, one last thing. The score was pretty good in this episode. Well done.
Yep, that's, they actually reused the scores from previous episodes, but you know, that's one of the neat things about Star Trek. They reuse everything because their budgets were so tight. I enjoy also doing this, you guys, with you and for you guys out there. I hope you like our new microphones. Hopefully, you'll come through on this also. Remember, if you want to contact us, remember you can email us at yellingatgas@gmail.com or find us on our Facebook page, Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe on YouTube and all the other podcasting things that are out there. And we'll see you next time on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Take care, Mike.
Take care, Captain. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
I never get involved.